very much. My remarks tonight will be introduced by proposing two toasts. First, I propose a toast to Congress for two remarkable achievements that are expected yet tonight. First, Congress is expected to approve the Nunn Amendment to the tax bill. For those of you who haven't followed this, the Nunn Amendment authorizes $74 billion additional tax cut between 1980 and 1983 if federal spending increases are inflation plus 1% or less. In other words, the percentage increase in federal spending is less than or equal to inflation plus 1%, 1980 to 1983, and the budget is balanced by 1982, and the federal share of GNP is reduced to 19.5% by 1983. And if those three conditions are met, the tax bill authorizes $74 billion additional of tax cut by 1983 if all three of those conditions are met. Oh, I know that this is largely an election year politics and that one Congress cannot bind another on these matters. But I am encouraged that most of Congress wants to run on this specific platform. I'm also intrigued that while the Republicans were up peddling the Kemp-Roth version of a free lunch, a young Democratic senator from Georgia recognized that Congress was prepared to accept a responsible reduction of both spending and taxes. The Nunn Amendment to the tax bill has passed the Senate 65 to 20. It passed the House at the initiative of the House Republicans and is now in conference committee. And the conference committee, I understand, is trying to figure out a way to go against the wishes of both houses of Congress and is having an awkward time with that. But at the moment, my expectation is that possibly by the time that we leave tonight, if I speak long enough, Congress will have approved the Nunn Amendment, a statutory reduction of federal income taxes that is contingent upon quite stringent controls on federal spending. The second grand event that I expect by the close of business tonight is that Congress is likely to adjourn in order to go home to run for re-election. No man is quite safe when Congress is in session. No woman may be very safe when Congress goes home. But that's another problem. Nothing quite like makes my day more than to hear that some leading congressman has been fooling around, to hear that most of Congress is on a junket, or to hear that the whole of Congress is adjourned. I've never understood the press criticism of junkets, or fooling around either, for that matter. Few policy decisions in our lifetime, I think, were quite as mischievous as paying congressmen enough to live on, or the decision to air condition Washington. In any case, Congress is about to adjourn for a while, an occasion to celebrate. To Congress. Second, I propose a toast to Howard Jarvis and to his sibling or clone in Michigan, Robert Tisch. In a debate on tax limitation last spring, which seems forever ago now, my distinguished opponent managed to call me in the same debate a right-wing ideologue, carpetbagger, ivory tower economist. I conceded the last and worst of these charges. This summer, however, a remarkable thing happened. Mr. Jarvis of California and Mr. Tisch of Michigan, by extraordinary effort on their part, managed to make my views appear moderate, reasonable, and responsible. On occasion, since such distinguished governors as Governor Brown of California, Governor Milliken of Michigan, and Governor Thompson of Illinois, since they have also endorsed general tax limitation, on occasion I questioned whether my own views were going soft. But since I always thought of myself as being moderate, reasonable, and responsible, I owe Jarvis and Tisch my thanks for making this apparent to others. To Howard Jarvis and Robert Tisch. My remarks tonight are addressed to the topic, "The Growth of Government is the Tide Turning." The simple answer to this question is yes, for a while. The more important answer is yes, for the future that we make it. For the indefinite future, if those of us who are committed to a community based upon personal responsibility and organized by consent, if those of us who share these views do not relax, if we continue to probe the reasons for the conditions that we face, and if we continue to promote the ideals and institutions of a community of free people. Let me give you some summary facts. For 150 years of American history, federal spending for domestic programs was seldom more than about 1% of national output. In 1929, about the time many of us were born, total government spending was 10% of gross national product, and federal spending was 2.5% of GNP. In 1973, the peak year of the prior economic cycle, total government spending was 1/3 of gross national product, and federal spending was about 22.5% of GNP. In the 44 years since 1929, thus, the total government share of GNP had increased 3.3 times, the share of GNP had increased 3.3 times, and the federal government share had increased 9 times. In 1978, the government shares of national output are about the same as in 1973, after increasing sharply during the 1974-1975 recession, and then declining steadily since that time. So the evidence is that in the last or maybe next to last year of the present economic cycle, the governmental share of total national output in the United States has been essentially the same as in the peak year of the prior cycle. So there has been no relative growth since 73 and a relative decline since 1975. The rapid relative growth of government is one of the most important phenomena of our lifetime. It has happened almost entirely in our lifetime. To repeat, back in 1929, governmental share of output was 10%, and the federal share of output was about 1 in 40, or 2.5%. This rapid relative growth of government is one of the most important phenomena of our lifetime, but neither the rapid growth through 1973 nor the relative stability since that time are very well understood. Is there a general reason to be concerned? Why did it happen? And what can be done about it? The sad fact is that there is no general understanding of this most important phenomenon. Let me briefly summarize the major theories that have been offered to explain the relative growth of government. This doesn't exhaust the explanations that have been offered, but the total number of explanations are rather larger than the number of facts. The first theory I will describe as the naive liberal theory, or the Woodrow Wilson or George McGovern or somebody's theory, the naive liberal theory. This theory is that the reason that government has grown as the United States has become more and more wealthy is that government is responsive and efficient, and that people want relatively more government as income grows. In the economist's term, this would be summarized by the statement that the income elasticity of the demand for government services is greater than one, that people prefer relatively more of these fine things as part of the better things of life as they have more income. Government will continue to... The government share of output in this case will continue to grow as long as the income elasticity is over one and income is in fact growing, and that the government share falls only when the income elasticity falls to unity or the total income growth goes to zero. In this outlook, there is no basis for concern if the theory is in fact confirmed. The problem, as with most theories by naive liberals, is that it has no basis in the facts. Government does not particularly vary either across time or across countries or states or jurisdictions with income. What one finds over time is that the governmental share has grown substantially over time, but that the governmental share grows most rapidly when income is falling, and the governmental share has grown least rapidly when income is rising. If you look across countries, say look at the 16 countries of the Organization of Economic and Something Development, OECD. In that cross-section of countries, the wealthy countries of the West, there is no relationship between the governmental share and the income level or the per capita income level of the country. The countries with the lowest governmental share in the OECD are in the following order: Japan, Switzerland, Australia, and believe it or not, the United States. The countries with the highest governmental share are the Netherlands and the Scandinavian countries. So you find within the OECD some of the highest income countries and some of the lowest income, some of the highest income countries in both the low governmental share countries as well as in the high governmental share countries. The one distinguishing characteristic between them is that the low governmental share countries tend to be federal systems, or more nearly like federal systems. So this idea that the governmental share has increased because government is responsive and efficient, and that the governmental services are among the finer things of life, and that we get our higher incomes and want more of them, just doesn't seem to be consistent with the facts. It doesn't explain why government grows faster when incomes are low or falling, as in a recession, and it doesn't explain the distribution of governmental shares across countries. The second explanation that has been offered, I might describe as the explanation by the realistic liberal. And in this explanation, the government is responsive, but it is not efficient. That whatever it is about the production process of government services, their costs must necessarily go up by the amount of wage increases in the private sector, because it is difficult, if not impossible, to bring about productivity increases in the public sector. Now, several economists, Mr. Bomal of Princeton and Professor Spann of I think the BPI, have written intelligently about this interpretation. In this particular interpretation, the governmental share will grow even if the income elasticity is not greater than one. In other words, even if governmental services are not among the finer things of life, as long as the income elasticity is greater than the price elasticity. In other words, if government is not efficient, if it cannot increase productivity, it must continue to pay wages that are at least commensurate with that in the private sector where productivity is growing, and if the income elasticity is greater than the price elasticity, then the governmental share will grow. The concern that is implicit in this particular approach is that the way to reduce the governmental share of output is to increase the efficiency of government by whatever means, by any number of ways of trying to wring out inefficiency in the total government. The evidence on this regard is mixed. There is enormous evidence of inefficiency in government. As it turns out, there is substantial inefficiency in every private organization with which I've ever been involved as well. The issue, and the difference possibly, is whether there are processes at work that lead to the reduction of the inefficiency in one sector and not in the other. The inefficiency in the government sector seems to be a dead weight in the sense that nobody has much of an incentive to work on it, and in some sense becomes an accepted part of the institution, whereas the still substantial inefficiency in most private organizations, and maybe the whole world isn't like Ford Motor Company, but I'm convinced that there's a substantial amount of inefficiency in all private organizations. The issue in those is whether there is an incentive, whether the system somehow builds in incentives to it to reduce the inefficiencies that exist at any given time. So there is a substantial amount of inefficiency. There is, however, no evidence that any of the vaunted efficiency improvements in the government have done anything whatsoever to reduce the governmental share. Now, I was, until 1975, before I went to the Ford Motor Company, made my reputation as a governmental efficiency expert, working for Mr. McNamara and working in the Federal Budget Office and so forth. I don't regard that activity as only part of the necessary process of growing up, because I think that we were doing some valuable things at the time. But among the expectations which I think are unrealistic in that regard is that an improvement in governmental efficiency by itself is likely to reduce governmental spending or the governmental share of total output. It still may be a worthwhile endeavor if it is directed at the conditions that lead to inefficiency, the whole incentive structure and the organizational and structural conditions, but that one possible outcome of that that I think that is unrealistic is that efficiency efforts by themselves are likely to lead to a reduced government spending or a lower governmental share. The third explanation I will call the special interest exploitation, or this might be called the bill averaging problem. Let me illustrate the bill averaging problem by the following example. Let's say that, let me pose two comparative situations. Let's say that you go into a bar or a restaurant with a group of friends under the expectation that each person will pay for his own tab, and then you at the end of the evening, you count up how much you drank and ate and so forth, and you paid your own tab. And that's the situation that, for the most part, exists in the private sector. But let's change that example, and let's say that you go into the bar or the restaurant knowing beforehand that the tab is going to be averaged. The bill is going to be averaged over everybody who participates in this particular type of club. In that case, the marginal cost of whatever you order as a drink or a dinner or something gets averaged over the whole group. And then check how much you have imposed on the cost of the group. The costs are not avoided. The costs are borne by the group. Nobody gets out of the restaurant without paying. But it's the nature of the system, it's the expectations when you go in that affect your behavior. If there is, in economist terms, any elasticity of demand for booze and food on your part, in the bill averaging phenomena, you're in a situation where you know that the bill will be averaged over the whole group when at the time that you make your order, you're going to drink more and you're going to eat more than you would in a situation in which you paid the bill yourself. Now, what I call special interest exploitation is not them, but it's us, in the sense that we all behave that way in that situation. It isn't just the bad guys, it's us good guys who behave the same way when we have an opportunity to spread the bill across somebody else. Now, the special interest exploitation, or this bill averaging explanation of the growth of government, all that it requires is that the rate of increase of the people who pay the bill is higher than the rate of increase of those people who have been able to claim the benefits at any given time. And under these circumstances, as long as I said there's any elasticity of demand for governmental services, this will lead to a government that is both over large and grows too fast. There is a lot of evidence for activities of this nature. A large part of what the government does is of this character of demanding services which are valuable services, but one demands more of them in a situation in which the bill is going to be averaged across the whole community than if the bill is paid by the immediate people expressing the demand. The response to that problem, the growth of government, the nature of the approaches that are relevant to trying to stop this particular phenomena are twofold. One is to try to organize broad coalitions, to try to organize coalitions of the taxpayers across which the bill is being averaged. The problem about that is that that coalition requires bidding more people of diffused interests than the coalition of people with the special interests or the beneficiary interests. The whole tax limitation approach, however, is an attempt to approach or to organize these broad coalitions of taxpayers to counter the effects of the coalitions of particular beneficiaries. The other approach is to try to restrain the opportunities of government to authorize special benefits. Now, the wise man who wrote the federal constitution in 1787 spelled out a specific set of functions in Article 1, Section 8, and made it very clear that they thought that the federal government should do nothing that was not authorized by those specific functions. Now, this constitutional restrictions on functions is essentially broken down in our lifetime, and there's hardly any conceivable activity now that the government would not regard it having the authority to do. Let me remind you, however, that this breakdown of the constitutional restrictions on federal functions has happened quite recently. As late as the 1950s, when the federal government first ventured into highway programs and into the education programs, the Federal Highway Act was called the Federal Defense Highway Transportation Act of, I think, 1956, and it was authorized on the rather spurious basis that we had to move tanks around the country quickly or something of that nature. The first major venture of the federal government in the education business was called the Defense Education Act, I think, of 1958, and was authorized on the basis that we had to train a bunch of economists and mathematicians to protect us against the Russians. The rationale there was also rather spurious. But at least as late as the 1950s, Congress and the President felt obliged to authorize new federal functions in terms of the specifically enumerated functions in Article 1, Section 8. But beginning in the 1960s, more under President Johnson than under Kennedy, there no longer seemed to be any effective constraints in the range of functions that the federal government might undertake. I think that there's a possibility that those functions might be more narrowly described in the future, but I am not optimistic. The fourth explanation for the growth of government that I want to offer, I will call democratic exploitation. In this case, it's not exploitation by special beneficiary groups, but it's exploitation of fundamentally the upper half of the income distribution by the lower half. In this case, the government maximizes the tax revenue that it can collect from the upper half of voters and sets tax rates in the upper half of the income distribution at the revenue-maximizing tax rates. In this case, government will grow under one of two circumstances, either where the revenue-maximizing tax rates increases, possibly due to a deterioration of conditions in other countries or an improvement in tax collection technology, or if the income distribution widens. In other words, a higher proportion of the income is above that of the median voter. What might conceivably have led to this? There are a variety of conditions that might have led to, an increase in the revenue-maximizing tax rate. One is increased centralization of the American political system. Second is improved tax collection technologies. Third is the deterioration of alternatives in other countries. The second condition that that would lead to a growth of government, given this theory, is where the rate of increase of income above that of the median voter is higher than that of below the median voter. That could happen from basically underlying economic phenomena, in other words, an increasing dispersion of income in the economy, or it could happen by an extension of the franchise toward lower income groups. Now, the evidence in the United States is that at least over long periods of time, income distribution has become tighter, not more widely distributed, it's become tighter. So this democratic exploitation, the exploitation of the upper half of the income distribution by the lower, has not led to an increase in the growth of government because of an increase in the inequality of income, but because of the reduction in the income of the median voter. In other words, by an extension of the franchise to lower income people. Now, what's the evidence on this? The evidence is fairly makes a good bit of sense. As I said, on the income distribution itself, there is no evidence that there has been an increase in the inequality or the dispersion of income or the underlying income distribution. But there have been three major increases in the franchise. In the 1920s, the franchise was extended to women. This had hardly any effect on the income of the median voter, because in effect it was extending the franchise to women of families who were already represented by the husband. So the effect of the extension of franchise to women had no significant redistributive effects operating through the governmental budgeting system, and the major political consequence of that extension of the franchise seemed to be prohibition. In the 1960s, the franchise was in effect extended to blacks, although they had nominally had the franchise since the late 1860s, but not meaningfully. And in the 1960s, the franchise was extended to blacks in a meaningful way, and that did substantially lower the income of the median voter, and it had a substantial effect in increasing governmental spending on redistributive programs. In other words, the evidence is consistent with this particular hypothesis in that case. In the 1970s, the franchise has been extended to 18-year-olds. And that has had much the same effect as the extension of franchise to women, which is almost nothing, because the 18-year-olds, at least originally, have the outlook, basically, of the families of their parents who are already represented. And the primary effect of the extension of franchise to the 18-year-olds was associated with the general move to eliminate the draft. What's the basis for concern in this case? The basis of concern in this case is that of from a selfish point of view, that of the upper income voters with an income greater than the median, and in a more general sense, the effect of the incentive to set revenue maximizing tax rates on the total income of the community. The types of research that are called for in this case is we've got to have some sense of what are the reasons for a change in this revenue-maximizing tax rate, whether it is due to just a change in tax collection technology, changes in types of the sources of income, changes in the types of taxes, and the effects of centralization of our overall political structure. What are the reasons for change in the relationship between the income and the median, income above the median voter and the income of the median voter? Has it been due to changes in the income distribution, changes in the franchise, and so forth? The fifth explanation I will call oligarchy explanation. And this one, in this explanation, one doesn't even pay any attention to the democratic structure of the government, and just says that the government has always and continues to collect as much taxes from any given economy over which they have authority as they can. In that case, it has nothing to do with the income distribution or the franchise. It's that tax rates on all income classes and all political groups are set at revenue-maximizing rates, and that the growth of government in this case is entirely due to an increase. The relative growth of government is entirely due to an increase in the revenue-maximizing rates. due possibly to improvements in tax collection, in centralization, deterioration of conditions in other nations, deterioration of non-taxable income opportunities, so forth. There is a recent article by Paul Rubin suggesting that the relative growth of government in the United States is substantially explained by these non-political, non-economic factors, by some things like improved tax collection and changes in the source of income, not necessarily the distribution, but the types of ways in which people earn income. There are important new articles by Jeff Brennan and by Jim Buchanan of BPI on what one might be able to do about government of this nature. They've been writing several articles recently about how to write the constitution for a Leviathan. In other words, how to write a constitution for a government over which you have no control after the constitution is written. And those are articles that I commend to you. The sixth and most discouraging interpretation, these interpretations get more discouraging as the list grows from the first to the last, but the sixth and the last one that I will discuss is the interpretation that government just grows over time. There isn't any behavioral theory in it at all. The unfortunate thing is it's very consistent with the evidence. There is a very interesting article by Mansur Olson, who's quite a creative guy, who's looked at some evidence in both, you know, among American states and among Western countries. And if you look at the governmental share of personal income among American states, there are two variables that explain that share explain a lot of the variations in that share. One is when the state was first formed, and the older the state is, the older the longer ago the state was first formed, the higher governmental share. If you control for one other thing, whether the state was a member of the Confederacy. And so the governmental share of personal income in the United States is a strong positive function of when the state was formed, and a strong negative function of whether they had lost a war, whether they were a member of the Confederacy. So Massachusetts is more than Michigan, and Virginia is more than Texas, but Massachusetts is more than Virginia in governmental share, because Virginia was reorganized by the feds after the Civil War. If you look at cross-national comparisons across countries, Mansur's evidence is somewhat weaker, but is much the same, in that you find that the governmental share of output is a positive function of when the nation was formed, and a negative function of how recently they've lost a war, and it declines as a function of how recently they've lost a war, which suggests that governments just grow and grow and grow until they lose a war. The winter war is a disaster, but if you lose a war, then governments get reorganized, and then you start all over again. What can you do in this case? If this is the most powerful interpretation, this is a very gloomy outlook. Is it suggested that the government's going to continue to grow in relative terms? It seems like it's inevitable. Unless you can somehow figure out a way to lose a war to some generous nation such as the United States. Well, as you can discern, there are almost more plausible theories about the growth of government than there are discriminating facts. The sad fact is that the growth of government, maybe the most important general phenomenon of our lifetime, is not very well understood. As a consequence, those of us who are concerned about the phenomenon are well advised to support a number of different types of policy changes. I think one should not give up on measures to increase the efficiency of government, although it's very trying. I've been at it most of my adult lifetime. It's very trying. It's very discouraging. The gains often seem to be small. But we don't understand this phenomenon very well. And under those circumstances, it's much better to use a shotgun than a rifle, because you might hit something. The second is to try to reduce those special interest programs that are financed by general taxes. by supporting President Carter when he tries to cut down these water projects instead of criticizing it, just as an example. Third is to promote the decentralization of taxing authority, not the centralization of taxing authority, as President Nixon supported with his general revenue sharing and his New American Revolution, and as Jarvis Gann have implemented in the state of California by shifting the tax burden toward the state. Third, and I think this is not so intuitive, but I think third, it's important to oppose what have been the traditional, what I'll call Brookings types of tax reforms. Because these types of tax reforms almost universally lead to an increase in the revenue-maximizing tax rate. They increase the tax-raising potential of the government. So to oppose the types of tax reforms that Joe Peckman and Brookings and most of the writing community has supported now for 40 years, I think most of those types of tax reforms should be opposed. And finally, and maybe most important, but I can't promise you that because I don't understand this phenomenon well enough to be confident, to support general comprehensive tax and expenditure limitation in ways that do not lead to centralization of taxing authority. What is the role of the individual in this perspective? This perspective also seems so global and so almost beyond us. These processes, the growth of government, or the turning of the tide, neither of these processes are inevitable. Neither of them are beyond human interaction or human intervention. Nor can they be brought about by just a small number of determined people. In fact, you wouldn't want it that way. You've got to recognize that there are large groups of small numbers of determined people whose interests are very different from ours and are not consistent with those of a free society. So one should not despair that you cannot bring about a federal constitutional amendment in 90 days. Don't give up. Or don't give up at the level of a state if you can't do it in several years. One would not want such fundamental issues to be resolved by whims or by a small number of determined people working for a short period of time. For the moment, the actions of those of us who have been promoting general tax limitation, I think, are best described as ratifying the change in general opinion rather than being the primary agent of that change. Those of us who are concerned about the growth of government should not relax, even if we are successful in promoting constitutional state and federal tax limitations. Any effective constitutional constraint requires continuing broad support. Otherwise, a constitution becomes only a parchment barrier to those who have the power to break or to ignore the most explicit constitutional language. We must continue to promote the ideals and the understanding that would support the continuing consent necessary for constitutional constraints. Let me end the evening with a final toast. May the efforts of this group be effective in promoting these ideals and this understanding, so that we and our children may live in a community based on consent.